All right, so today we're not going to be starting a new series. We're going to chronicle the decline of the church in America in order to see what happened generally and perhaps get some ideas of how we can reverse course or, turn the ship. Make sense? So I this is in between series, and I've been wanting to talk about this. I think it would be helpful. And apparently I'm dehydrated today. I did not sleep hardly at all last night because it's a Saturday night. That's just what happens. I'm like, every Saturday night, I'm staring at the ceiling. I'm like, why can I not sleep? And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's Saturday night. I can never sleep on Saturday nights. but anyway, all right, so we speak about church reform often. And so this is why we need it. I'm not a historian either. I do want to say that. I'm not a specialist in history, although I know a little bit about this, but we're not going to go into super detail. But I believe the decline in the United States began in the early 1800s. So, you know, 50 years before the Civil War. The seeds of decline were in the soil for 200-300 years, of course, since the Enlightenment, since Immanuel Kant. The seeds for apostasy and decline were there. But the decline going mainstream, not Harvard, you know, Harvard had already begun to decline by the early 1800s, the elite and whatnot, but the mainstream apostasy began in the early 1800s. And I want to break that into three different sections, basically 1830 to 1885, and then to about, you know, early 1900s, and then to the 60s. And so we'll break this up into three areas. In the early 1830s, and maybe some of you can guess some of this, but in the early 1830s, what do you think was a major theological shift that was happening in the nation, throwing off the old, putting on the new, which was false, which had terrible ramifications for the future? Yeah. I'm sorry, what? Feminism? Arminianism is correct. Arminianism is correct. The rise of Arminianism in America in the early 1800s is perhaps the central theological problem, at least. And so the old theology of the Puritans and the Pilgrims, which was God-centered, sovereign-centered, was now becoming and shifting to man-centered. But anytime you shift theologically, salvation being God-centered to man-centered, it's going to shift the practices of the church and the emphases of the church. And so the shift from God-centered to man-centered is going to have a snowball effect in every other area in the church life. So you begin to see revivalists like Charles Finney, for example, and you've probably heard of Charles Finney. He is a striking looking person. If you ever look him up, he's wild-haired and wild-eyed, and he has like crystal blue eyes. And people said that he used to be able to just like stare into their soul. He was a very captivating person, and he invented, or at least popularized, what was called the anxious bench, where large emotional gatherings were whipped into a frenzy with high-powered emotion and rhetoric and music. And people were called to come to the front of the building and have a seat on the anxious bench, where I think of it like as a timeout for Christians, where you go and think about all the things you've done wrong. And so that eventually leads to what? The altar call, right? And so the idea of salvation was no longer God-centered, and the church was called to proclaim the gospel and teach the nations to obey his law. It was man needs to be persuaded in his intellect and in his reason. He's perfectly capable of connecting the dots and choosing Jesus of his own accord. He's not that fallen or depraved. What we need is not regeneration. What we need is persuasion. And persuasion comes about through various techniques. And so Charles Finney would teach things. He believed revival was essentially making the best use of proper means. Revival could be engineered. And he, of course, had the techniques. He had the drama. He had the music. He had the show. And that, of course, bleeds into what we think of as revivalism today, which is a massive problem in our church. If you think about church life, Think about a megachurch, for example. It's largely known, from my understanding, is it emotional? Are there emotional appeals? What is it about it that's emotional? The music is very emotional, hypnotic, not very penetrating, not very specific, certainly not very critical of anything. Like we sing songs that are talking about God wiping out his enemies, nothing like that, right? Very positive, very mainstream, very palatable, lights, all the cultural, bells and whistles that are used by the world to evoke emotion at a concert, at a particular concert. The speech is also designed to bring you up and take you down, to make you laugh, to make you cry. It's rhetorically designed that way, filled with tweetables and whatnot. It's all a very emotional experience. It's all very individualistic. I mean, imagine in a megachurch them speaking about God's faithfulness to covenantal families, and really getting into the weeds on those particular things. You don't ever get into the weeds. It's very basic. It's very individualistic. It's emotional. It's experienced-based. And the idea is to evoke an experience. I mean, they even call it a worship experience. And they will cancel church on some Sundays because of various reasons, because it's not a Sunday where they have enough employees to have the full experience. And that's often around Christmas time where their employees are wrapped up in the plays and things like that. But it's not just in the services themselves, it's just in the psyche of the people. The people equate the Holy Spirit with the proper use of means, not obedience of the law, not meditation upon the law of God, delighting in the law, boo. It's the proper use of means in experiences. And this is, of course, in camp life, where they do the same sort of stuff, but it's in the wilderness, it's under the stars, it's with all your friends. You don't have any responsibilities like a crying little brother or taking out the trash. It's just sort of like a perfect environment of bliss, no responsibilities, just fun all day with your best friends, under the stars, beautiful weather, campfire, evocative, emotional appeals, and look at the, lo and behold, you became a Christian. You had that moment. You had that crisis moment. That is revivalism, and this is why we never send our kids to camp, because I didn't want them to have these moments apart from their church and their family. It's emotionally stirring, revivalistic moments. I don't mind sending kids for free babysitting, but I, like VBS and things like that. But that is what VBS is. They're trying to evoke some sort of a vibe to persuade these children to make a decision for Christ. Okay, I'm just trying to capture the essence of what is left over of revivalism. That comes from Arminianism. And Charles Finney is like, he's like the poster child, if you want to look into that a little bit more. The Puritans, though, however, were not free of blame. The Puritans did not, they did not pass the faith down to their children. They grew rich and they grew complacent, and their children became Unitarians, which is the precursor to what we might think of today as liberals. Liberals, they denied the Trinity. The gospel became purely the social gospel, what's good for the poor and the powerless, things like that, those Unitarians. So the Puritans weren't free of blame either. And a lot of it had to do with the Puritans, I believe, being infected by Arminianism and revivalism, and that now they were wanting to see their people have these inner personal experiences, these crisis moments. How do you know that you know that you know that you know that you're a Christian? Well, how would you answer? Yeah, Aaron says, well, I was baptized. Well, yeah, but do you know that you know that you know? How can you know? And most people would say, well, I remember when I was 17 years old, I had this moment, I was really crying, God spoke to me. That's how I know I'm a Christian. See how it's experience-based, it's individual-based. It's not based on the signs and sacraments that God gives us to provoke our assurance. How do I know I've been baptized? Because God says baptism saves. Now, it doesn't mean what you think it means, all right? And that would take a long, but God, baptism is one of the means through faith that God uses to sanctify me and to give me assurance and to, I'm in the church, I'm with my Christian friends, I'm following his commandments, I'm not living in unrepentant sin, I've been baptized, I take the Lord's Supper. I look around, I look like a Christian, like, I pray to Jesus. I look like her. Yeah, but are you, though? How can you know on the inside if you really are? Well, now I don't feel like a Christian anymore. See, that's what it does. What I need is to give my life to Jesus one more time. So it moves away from law and obedience and sign and sacrament and objective Christianity to an individualistic, the church is now just a tool for to evoke my emotions, to individualistic, repetitive, lack of assurance, emotion based. So that's, I think that is a huge problem, and it began largely in the early 1800s. Another aspect of this is that the gospel then, in Arminianism, the gospel is no longer about the kingdom advancing over all of life and God's sovereign plan for history, for all areas of life. It's about you experiencing inner salvation, period. All right. So the gospel becomes not so much, one second, Miss Deborah, the gospel becomes not so much about kingdom advance, but about personal salvation. See what I mean? It's individual salvation. The gospel is Jesus died on the cross for my sins. Do you choose to believe him? Will you ask him into your heart? That's where and that is a part of the gospel. Don't get me wrong. What good is the world being reconciled to Christ if I'm not? Right? There is an aspect of individuality here, but the gospel is actually much bigger. When Paul talks about the gospel, he says the gospel was preached to Abraham beforehand that he would be, a father of many nations and those nations would inherit the earth. Yeah, but what about my, personal salvation? No, the gospel is bigger than you as an individual. It's about the sweeping advance of the kingdom, the reconciliation of all things under Christ. It's big. And so then the Arminianism switching to inner decisions, the will of man becoming the hinge upon which salvation turns, and the church then restructuring itself to make proper use of the right means to evoke decisions, the advance of the kingdom globally and societally is on the back burner. See what I mean? I believe this is what has happened. So no longer is the kingdom coming for law and media and art and science and politics. It's coming for your individual salvation. I want you to get saved. Okay. Make sense? All right. Miss Deborah, did you have a question? Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I did all that. I did all that too. Yeah, first of all, that feeling is not salvation, no. So I think this would be the best thing for you in this moment. First of all, God can draw straight lines with a crooked stick. I was baptized in that world. And I believe I was saved from a very young age, even though I'd go to church and everyone was literally just jumping around, biting on the furniture, and it was just a craziness. They still knew the basics of the gospel, you know what I mean, stuff like that. So God can draw straight lines with crooked sticks. I'm not saying that. What I'm talking about is the basis of your salvation. What can give you a sense of confidence that God's not going to condemn you for your sins is not that feeling you had back when you were a kid. It's that, am I obeying him now? Am I walking in the truth? Am I abiding in his teachings? Yeah, I mean, it's all connected. It's all connected. But people who are struggling with assurance, usually they're basing their assurance on an experience that they had, a subjective experience that they had at some point in time, which is not able to be measured or even halfway remembered, instead of basing, I know I'm a Christian because, I'm in a church. I didn't get excommunicated. I'm following Jesus. I have Christian friends. I've actually said no to all my the old friends. This is what makes me a Christian. Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. I'm trying to keep his commandments. I confess my sin. So it's that's a more solid rock to stand on than the feeling and the catharsis that one experienced in a mob at some point when the bass drum was pumping. So, which can be very deceptive, that can be self-deceiving. All right, hope that helps. Along with that comes apocalypticism, Remind me, what is apocalypticism? World's about to end. Don't buy no green bananas. You better listen to us. And along with apocalypticism comes this teaching in the early 1800s by Darby, largely. His name was Darby, called the secret rapture. See? Salvation is about your inner experience. You're going to be inner saved. You're going to have inner feelings. This world is not your home. You're just a passing through. It's all going to burn. So what we need to do is we need to get out of here somehow. We need to escape. Salvation becomes less about transformation and victory. Salvation becomes about escape, which is an age-old pagan concept. We don't see redemption and transformation of the world. We see escape from the world. And we're going to escape in a secret rapture. And he had all the Bible verses to back it up. One of the ways he came to this conclusion is by separating Israel from the church. So Israel had one plan of salvation. The church, Gentile Christians, had another plan of salvation. And if you apply that hermeneutic all the way across the Bible, you can start to see how he came up with this, or how the demon came up that explained it to him, came up with this secret rapture concept. Yes, Ellen? His name was Joseph Darby. His first name is, I'm sorry? John Nelson Darby in the early 1800s. And he's not the only one to be blamed. There's a lot of people to be blamed. Eventually, this dispensationalism is spread through the Scofield Bible, which was published in the early 1900s, 1909. And then the cults started filling the void. A lot of cults. The Mormons, for example. He gets his tablets from Moroni, the moronic angel, the demon. He gets his golden tablets. Of course, he lost them or can't find them. But he has all the information written down. And lo and behold, he's the true church. And guess what? The time is at hand. It's all about to end. Don't buy no green bananas. And you better join our new church. We're the church of the latter days. We're in the last days. We need to purify the church. We need to get true church. You need to come out of your old dead churches and get rebaptized. So that's one thing you know about people who have apocalyptic. We better purify the church right now because the end is coming and we're going to fly all home away from here. They're always rebaptizing everybody. They love to rebaptize. They don't count baby baptisms for surely. And they don't count like 90% of adult baptisms either because they're the pure church. This is Church of Christ. You got to get dunked in their water. It's the true church. The Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses. A lot of Anabaptist movements, and I won't keep naming names, but this is in a lot of our DNA in Baptist fundamentalist circles. It's just in the DNA, even though they might not hold fast to all the things. It is a movement of purifying the church immediately, not a gradual reformation, but the end is near, and we need to get ready because one fine morning we'll all fly away. Jehovah's Witnesses as well. That was all part of it. Rebaptizers. You know, when you rebaptize someone, what are you saying to that person? Well, you know, now baptism, it didn't stick. But baptism is a sign of the covenant from God to man. And it is the sign of inclusion into the covenant. When you're getting rebaptized, what you're saying is you were never in the covenant. You were never in the church. In fact, your church wasn't a church. That's what rebaptism, that's what caused the controversy, one second, Miss Deborah, in the 1500s, when the Baptist movement emerged and they began to rebaptize all of the Christian West. The reason it caused so many political fights is because what they're saying is, you weren't ever a true church. None of you were actually even members of a church. And if you're not baptized, what should you also not be doing? Lord's Supper. You're not genuine. And so the Baptist movement of the 1500s, I believe it was apocalyptic. I believe it was a purifying movement. I believe it had the early stages of all of this. And they were rebaptizing all of the West, all of Christianity, all of Christendom. So you could see why there was a lot of, you could see why, even though we really like him, Mr. Bunyan was put in jail. This was a huge issue because the church and state were connected at that point in time. So not only, you're saying the king's not a Christian. Like, you're going to get in, there's going to be a lot of political things. I got to rush through this. Go ahead.
To
Yeah, or your church wasn't even an actual church. Most people don't have any, most people, think about this. Remember the revivalism. Remember what's going on, the Arminianism. So now baptism is being interpreted, and this isn't a class on baptism, it's just as a sign from the person to the crowd of what? It's an outward sign of a inward change in here. See how it's individualistic? You see how it's inner? It's I have decided. It's invisible. It's experiential. I've had this crisis experience. I've had this campfire experience. And I need to testify to all of you of the inner change that has taken place in me so that I can be now a part of the church. And I can be considered a Christian. And I can feel like a Christian. So you have this person doing that. And oftentimes they'll get baptized over and over again because, okay, I think I am one now. Let me tell everybody. But baptism is not a sign from man to the other people in church primarily. And it's not a sign of an inward change that's not taught in the Bible anywhere. It's a sign from God that goes along with his promise. It would be like saying the rainbow is a sign of an outward sign of an inward change. Well, the rainbow is not just for you, buddy. You know, and it was like there before you were born. It's not. The rainbow, God speaks his gospel promise, and along with it comes the sign. It's always God's promise and his sign. Here's the promise, Abraham. Now circumcise. He always gives eyes and ears. He always makes it earthy and tangible. But in the rise of Arminianism, in the rise of all of this stuff, the tangible is excluded for the internal and the mystical and the subjective. That's what I believe what is largely taking place. Think about you. If someone wants to go into the ministry, they want their life to have meaning. They want it to have purpose. They're like, I need to be a missionary, or I need to be a pastor. It's in their mind that this world is not our home, and these things are less sacred. And we're going to get to where all this comes from in a second. 1830s, the first government school is established. Not the first public school. Christians have always taught the neighbors how to read. Nothing wrong with that. But the first government school that was controlled by the federal secular government that intentionally excluded Jesus from the curriculum was in the 1830s by a man named Horace Mann. He said, let the home and the church teach their own creeds, but let the common school, the public sphere, inculcate morality and good citizenship. So now morality is divided from the Bible and from objective truth. 1859, Charles Darwin gives everybody a hook to hang their hats on. They can finally say goodbye to God because now we know where the origin of the species was. It was from the physical world, not the spiritual world. So he's starting to see this. What are we seeing over and over with all these things? We're starting to see a dualism emerging. 1885, Oliver Wendell Holmes, he was a Supreme Court justice. He began to teach that the law of the United States, or any human laws, are not ultimately established on God's law, but are to be discovered to be by reason, man's reason. So we see once again God's law being kicked to the curb. Blackstone's Commentaries, which was the number one textbook in law schools throughout the whole country, was biblical. It was based on biblical or law, or at least his laws were. He would show how the laws of the United States were grounded in biblical law and biblical truth. They believe in ultimate truth. But around the 1800s, men like Oliver Wendell Holmes began to teach otherwise. The law is not from God. The law is from man and is subjective and can be discovered through reason. And so that begins to happen. Blackstone said this. He said, upon these two foundations, the law of nature and the law of scripture, depend all human laws. So that was the main textbook of the law schools in all of the United States before the 1800s. Holmes, of course, rejects that. And obviously, all of our law schools reject God's law completely. In fact, the churches reject God's law, except for a few, by and large. All of this, of course, is coming from, and I'm not going to go into it, but all of this is coming from the dominant philosophy, which was taught by Immanuel Kant in the 1700s. He began to lay the seeds of this in elite schools. Immanuel Kant taught that there was a sphere of the spirit. These are not his words, but there was like a spiritual, supernatural sphere, and then there was a tangible, physical sphere. There was a sphere of reason and experience and experimentation, and where you could know that you know things here. And then there's a spiritual realm where reason and the physical does not interact. I do believe that all of these basic changes in the society and in the church were changes that basically harmonized and synthesized with Immanuel Kant's philosophy. It was a regurgitation of Plato in a sense, not exactly. Plato creates two worlds. Immanuel Kant creates two worlds, but they're just not exactly the same worlds. And so now what you have is the church was in the sphere of the supernatural over here, where you can't really know things for certain. Okay? The only place you can know for certain is in the sphere of the physical and the experiential, where human reason and science can make discoveries and know things. So you have this dualism from Immanuel Kant. And I really do believe you can see that in everything the church is doing. You have a sacred and you have a secular. You want to go into the ministry, you got to go into the spiritual realm to have true meaning, right? If faith is about emotion, it's about experience, it's not about certainty or facts or knowing your Bible truths. It's not about that. It's about the emotional, the inner, the subjective, the mystical. It's not about the fact that you took bread and wine this last Sunday. So it's all very separated like this. All right, I think that's essentially what's going on. And this is why when Christians say, hey, why isn't the government obeying Deuteronomy 7, verse 12? Oh, no, that's the church. This is the government. This is this dualism constantly. And I think that's essentially all of that is at the center of what happened in America. Now, if we're going to counter that, we need a different worldview, a different philosophy, not Immanuel Kant, not Kantism or dualism of any kind. What we need is the Reformed view, which, or the Kuyperian view is another word for it, teaches that Christ is over and teaches on and is concerned with, what do we say around here? All of life. See, that's our core motto, because that's essentially what America needs is reform, and reform is unraveling all of that dualism that emerged in the early 1800s. All right? So that's a real simplistic overview. We got 5 minutes to see what else happens. As this dualism injects itself into Christianity, think about it this way. The Bible is in the sphere of the supernatural. Can we know those things for certain? According to the world, according to Kant and according to the worldview that's shaking up, you can't know these things for certain. It can be your truth. You could hold to it. But over in the world of science, there's really no ultimate truth like that. You can't really. Well, couldn't we use our reason to find out if the Bible's telling the truth, to see if Jesus was raised from the dead using reason and maybe studying history and archaeology? No, you can't know these things. Only what you can know with science and experimentation can you truly and certainly know. And so the church, by and large, began to reject things like the virgin birth, the resurrection of Jesus, and began to reinterpret these things as poetry and as metaphor, right? And this liberalism in that particular time, in the early 30s and 40s, it was called modernism. This modernism began to capture all of the major institutions. Liberals, like conservatives, start things, and liberals take them over and ruin them. That's how it's worked in the last 200 years. And so the modernists began to take over, and they essentially took over all the Christian institutions in the country. The Presbyterian Church fell to modernism, liberalism, Unitarianism, this dualism, this Kantianism, I believe. Although I'm not a professional philosopher or anything like that. But the Presbyterian Church fell, Lutheran Church fell, Anglican Church fell, Baptist Church fell. They all fell. Boom. Liberal. The true Christians inside of these groups separated themselves, came out from among them and began to start new things, new Bible schools and new camps, and you have what was called the fundamentalist movement. That was, and there, that's where the word fundamentalism comes from. It was from a paper that was published in California, I believe, outlining the basic fundamentals of the faith, the virgin birth, the resurrection of Jesus. It was all these things. Yes, we can know these things because the Bible is our ultimate source of truth. We're rejecting this dualistic idea. We're saying, no, the Bible and Jesus is over all of things. We can know these things. Even though we can't look at them through a microscope, we can know them for certain. So they came, coming from that news article, they become known as the fundamentalists. Later, though, the fundamentalist side, the conservative side, has a break with a group called the evangelicals. The evangelicals begin to start institutions themselves, and they want to be seen as less ironic, or is it less, or more ironic? I don't know. Less fighting, less divisive, more inclusive, more feminine. And so you have groups, not in a negative sense, but they just, if you watched old school fundamentalists, they were just very aggressive, standing on the pulpits, waving American flags, sliding across, pounding the things. You're gonna burn, you know. That's that fundamentalism. And they were obviously a little overreactive, probably. The evangelicals are like, no, let's be more professional. Let's be more gentle, more Billy Graham style, more Billy Graham style. And so then you have this divide: the evangelicals and the fundamentalists. And there's still fundamentalists out there. You could go on an interesting history tour to go to a fundamentalist church that's still engaged in these old paths and these old fundamentalist things. But fundamentalism, though, still is holding on to. This is why I think it didn't reform and why it's going to die. It didn't break free of revivalism, and it didn't break free of apocalypticism. It didn't go back to, and it didn't break free of Arminianism. It still was using the ancient bench and the techniques and all of these various things. They were just holding on to an era like 1830. What we needed to hold on to is probably more like 1770s or maybe like 1520s. I don't know. They just were picking the wrong time. and so that happens in all the various churches. But then in this evangelical movement, you have the rise of a lot of great stuff, at least in that time. Youth for Christ, the Navigators, Campus Crusade for Christ, the National Association of Evangelicals, Christianity Today. Y'all have heard of these things. This was the rise of the evangelicals. Billy Graham, eventually the Christian Right. And this did well, I think, for by and large, but I don't believe they ever restored what we actually need, and that is all of Christ for all of life. They did not go back far enough. They believed new techniques, new methods, maybe if we're nice, you know, we can win the culture back to Christ. And but it was still man-centered, still Arminian, still apocalyptic, right? By the 1960s, what happens in the 1960s? And that's the early 70s, but not yet. The Jesus people are a product of the sexual revolution in the 1960s. So now the young people, basically, the 1960s is when we would say the culture is now no longer Christian. The rise of the sexual revolution, the hippie movement, what else is huge in the 60s is socialism. It takes over college campuses. So that now, essentially, college campuses are all socialists at this particular point in time. You have youth riots where they're holding hours of hate, like straight out of 1984. The 50s, basically, which saw some remnants of Christianity and traditional Christianity in old America, were thrown off in this riotous, drug-infested LSD sexual romp in the 60s. And that's when we could say, bang, you know, we've fully apostatized. Since the 60s, the Jesus people was a short-term reaction that took place after the 60s, I think the early 70s, where you see the rise of the Calvary Chapel movement, a few other things. And we've essentially gone downhill since then. Yeah, the Jesus freaks, and that was all part of that. A little reactionary. There were still these remnants of evangelicalism and remnants of fundamentalism holding on to their techniques and still doing the altar calls, and they still believed in the Bible. They just didn't know too much what was in there. You know, they believed it though. The question I wanted to end with is, like, as a nation, you know, are we still apostatizing? Yeah, I think so. It does, but doesn't it feel like in the last couple of years since COVID, there's been we've had a bit of a reaction, maybe. I think you see a little bit of a reaction, probably closer to the Jesus people's. I do believe COVID was a revival, essentially, a revival of humanism, not the disease itself. That was just a part of the revival. I do believe it was a COVID along with the woke movement. I refer to it, and others refer to it as the Great Awakening. And I do believe it was a great awakening, akin to the Second Great Awakening, akin to various other movements that took place. I do believe it unleashed something new in the world, and I believe what we're experiencing now is a pushback, a reset against it in the MAGA movement and in a lot of like online conservative talk shows. And you even have some hardcore pushback, or you get some pushback that's a little too extreme. I don't think any of that, though, is restoring the truths and the doctrines necessary to see long-term actual change. It's reactions, but are they saying all of Christ for all of life? Are they rejecting dualism? Are they rejecting apocalypticism? Are they rejecting the idea that the kingdom is just about interchange, and it's really about victory in history? Christ over the nations. I think these things that I often talk about and Pastor Scott often talks about, what we are aiming at here, I really believe is absolutely necessary to see actual multi-generational long-term reformation, not just a reaction, not just the same old. And so I had one last question. That's probably good right there. But let's go back over it just real quick. Arminianism. If you're going to see actual reformation, have to hate and fight Arminianism. Charles Finney and the maneuvers of persuading people to make decisions for Christ, got to reject all of that. You got to fight all of that, hate all of that. The complacency of the Puritans, where they didn't pass down the faith to the next generation. And they got, and that we got to reject all of that too. The gospel is purely your inner personal decision. Got to reject all of that. We got to develop a new understanding of the sacraments, of church, of ecclesiology. All of these things have to reject all the cultish nonsense. What about the government school system that inculcates the massive amount of society into humanistic schools under the guise of charity? Have to reject all of that. Have to fight all of it. Have to hate all of it. Have to repent of it as a nation completely. Charles Darwin, have to fight that. Have to hate that. Have to repent of all of that and establish, what does Jesus say about the origin of man? That means back to creation and a young earth, and he built the world in 6 days, etc. All of that. The law, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the rejection of God's law as the supreme law. I have to hate that. You have to get rid of that and say, no, God's law is supreme over this nation. The sacred, secular, you got to bring them back together. Christ over all of life. So it is a different paradigm and a different worldview, but I do believe it is essentially what we're, at least through our teaching, trying to accomplish at Christ Church, laying a foundation, which is different. It is a different foundation, and it's a tiny little foundation here, a little postage stamp foundation in Acadiana, so that we might see some long-term reformation. I think that's essential. So anyway, all right, hope you enjoyed it. Y'all have a great Lord's Day.